Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor for the 79th Legislative Assembly to order. For our first item of business, we need to adopt our interim rules for this committee. And I believe they're the same as other committees. There are a couple of changes from our past interim committees, none of which are, I think, real substantive. We are, I guess, putting in writing that the meetings of the committee shall be recorded into our committee rules. It's already the practice according to our chamber. What were the other changes? The field trips must have a written summary of those field trips. I believe that's new, and if you want to make amendments to the rules, you also need to notify the chief clerk of the House in writing.
Yes.
And so I think those are the additions to our rules.
Chair Hovey, I make a motion to adopt the rules as presented.
Representative Barreto moves that we adopt the House Interim Committee rules for business and labor as presented. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're so adopted. And with that, we will move into our informational meeting section. So I'll open an informational meeting. And our first segment of the informational meeting will be a presentation from the Oregon Liquor and Control Commission and staff about the regulatory structure they have over their venues. So with that, Renee Niedermeyer, Jesse Sweet, and Bill Schutte. Sorry, Bill. Welcome and thank you for being here to give our committee sort of an overview from the OLCC.
Perfect. Thank you. For the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Communications for the OLCC. To my right is Jesse Sweet, Director of APMP, and to my left is Bill Schutte, our state economist. What we're going to do today is quickly go through an overview of OLCC's regulatory environment for both cannabis and alcohol. We're going to go through the slides fairly quickly so that you have plenty of time for questions. We're going to focus first on cannabis, and then we're going to move to alcohol. We're going to start with a very short history of those two programs, a description of the program and how it is today, and the issues moving forward.
Thank you.
Okay. So Oregon is still in particularly the OLCC, the OLCC is still in the creation phase of the recreational cannabis industry. We started out with our first grower license in April of 2016. Our first retail license was in October of 2016. And now, 11 months later, we have 1,512 active licenses. However, Oregon has had a fairly long history with medical marijuana. In 1998, Oregon legalized marijuana, which was the oversight for that is with the Oregon Health Authority. And a lot of their focus has been on the cardholder, who can have a medical card. In 2014, voters passed the legalization of recreational marijuana and tasked the OLCC with regulation. That measure actually became effective in July of the following year in 2015. So in between, there was a legislative session in 2015 where certain fairly significant changes were made to both Measure 91 and OMMP, Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, in the OHA's programs. The 2016 session made changes to the 2015 statute for both agencies, and our 2017 session that we just had again made some fairly significant changes to statute as well. And those changes included things like changing the taxing system, requiring OLCC to do the tracking of marijuana through the regular our licenses, creating new licenses and new privileges, and so all of this, all of these changes, and we'll talk about, Jesse, I'll talk about a couple of some of the changes that came out of the 2017 session, has required a great deal of nimbleness and adaption at the OLCC, but also with our licensees and our applicants as the laws change and the rules change to reflect those changes in law. We had the, just to begin with, to get this program up and going, we had to create our initial set of rules. We tried as much as possible to borrow from other states and from alcohol law, but those regulations are in those requirements in the other states and alcohol are very different from recreational marijuana, so we've had to make some considerable adaptations there. We had to create, and we're still in process of revising, our electronic application and cannabis tracking system, and we also developed an online marijuana worker permit system. And again, as each change in law comes or a new license type is changed, we're in process right now, for instance, of changing our cannabis tracking system to reflect laws, changes in statute from the 2017 session. We've had to create processes and procedures and really work on this brand new program on and a lot of changes happening over time. How do we apply those consistently across the state? That's been a real focus for us. We've had to hire and train internal staff at the same time that we're writing or revising our rules and processes. So that's been a challenge for us. And I think probably most important of all is, in some cases, is that continual outreach and education for our licensees and our applicants. They need to know how to apply what's changed in the rules, what's changed in their processes. And so that's we'll talk a little bit about how we've done that. So one of the things that I've noticed sitting in my chair is there's a lot of confusion out there about who does what in this marijuana realm. So I thought I'd just quickly go through that. The Oregon Liquor Control, our responsibility is a licensing and enforcement for recreational marijuana businesses and the issuing of marijuana worker permits. But what's an interesting twist there is we can also produce and process and sell medical grade marijuana. And so those are the high dosage marijuana products that can only be sold to medical card holders, and they can buy that in our retail stores tax-free. The Oregon Health Authority still has it has the responsibility for the purely medical marijuana program. So it has growers and it has dispensaries, although there are a lot fewer of those now that the recreational system has come up. It sets the testing standards for the marijuana in both systems and the requirements for that type of testing. The Oregon Department of Revenue collects the marijuana taxes and distributes them. And so although they depend on us for auditing purposes because we track what's actually sold in our stores. So the Oregon Department of Agriculture has oversight mostly with our processors and our growers. So in the processors, where they come into play is with our commercial kitchens. They do the scale certification and food handling activities. And they also have oversight on what kind of pesticides can be used in our grow licenses. the local jurisdictions, the local law enforcement, the governing bodies, the code enforcement folks have oversight on all the illegal growths, the ones that aren't in our licensees. We only have oversight over and authority over our own licensees. So if it's something that is outside of our licensee system and it's not OHA, then we work closely with local law enforcement. The local cities and counties also do issue a land use compatibility statement from their city or county that basically says that this marijuana business is in the proposed location is an authorized land use, and we will not or cannot issue a license unless they have that. The local governments can also pass time, place, and manner regulations and on the operations of these businesses. Some cities and counties have require a business license. Others don't. Some have additional rules beyond ours, time, place, and manner rules, and others don't. And some have a complete application process as well. Also in statute, there are requirements that any licensee applicant provide proof that they have legal access to the water. And also in statute, applicants must estimate their energy use, and when they renew their license, they have to give us actual energy use. Cities and counties also have the option of opting out of having any recreational marijuana licenses. Those, at this point in time, if they adopt an opt-out ordinance, those need to be referred to the voters at the next general election. And we will stop, we will not issue any licenses while that's on the books in that particular entity. If they are opted out, they lose the opportunity to share in the tax revenue that comes from marijuana taxes, and they can opt back in at any time by rescinding the ordinance. What they can't do is opt out of home grow and personal use. That's not affected. So far, we have 90 cities and 16 counties who have opted out. A lot of those are in Eastern Oregon. We have 5 main license types and a certificate and a permit. So we have producers. Those are the folks that grow the marijuana. They can grow it indoor, they can grow it outdoor, or mixed. We see a lot of mixed cultivation where we have greenhouses or indoor facilities and outdoor grows as well. We have laboratories. These are certified by OHA, but they're licensed by us. They test marijuana for pesticides, mold, contaminants, and potency. We have processors. They're the ones who create the recreational and medical grade products. So processors make the edibles. They make concentrates, extracts, and topicals. So that's the license that does that kind of activity. Wholesalers buy and sell marijuana wholesale. Our retailers are the only license in the OLCC system that allows sales to consumers. And they can sell to consumers that are 21 years and older, and they can also sell medical grade items to medical card holders. When I say medical grade items, what I mean by that is a higher potency than is available to the recreational buyer that comes into the store. So only if you have a medical card can you purchase these products. You can also purchase them at higher quantities than the recreational user can. We have a research certificate which allows research on marijuana. We don't have any of those yet, but we have a couple of applications. And we have marijuana worker permits, where employees of any marijuana business, except the labs or the research certificates, all employees need to go through education and obtain a worker permit that's good for 5 years.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I am OLCC's Director of Administrative Policy and Process, and I'll be picking up the slides here for a little while. I'm going to start with running through some more detail on the privileges of each license type. The producer license, as Renee mentioned, is the grower, and OLCC regulates all aspects of recreational marijuana production. I would like to note that our current rules limit only the size of the mature canopy. That was tasked by the legislature for us to determine. There was a recent change last session to give us authority to limit immature canopy as well. So the way we determine that is a mature plant is a plant that's in flower, and an immature plant is a vegetative plant. So we'll be taking up rulemaking on the immature canopy later this fall. We share some authority with the Oregon Department of Agriculture over pesticide regulation. They have independent authority to regulate pesticides. We also have authority to suspend a license for illegal pesticide application. Also, OHA establishes the types of testing that marijuana must go through before going to market. And OLCC has enforcement authority to ensure that everything is properly tested before it reaches the market. We have set up a system of tiers for recreational grow sizes. The legislature directed us to do our best to equalize production for indoor and outdoor grows. We did that by using a factor of four. So for every square foot that an indoor grower can grow, an outdoor grower can grow 4 square feet, and that's because indoor grows can get multiple harvests during a year. So I won't go through all the numbers. They're on the slide there, but the tiers correspond to different license fees, and especially the micro tier one and micro tier two are very affordable licenses, which are designed to get everyone possible into the market. Next, we have the processors. There are certain prohibitions for processors, and processing can cover a range of activities from making edibles to topicals to concentrates and extracts. So the first prohibition is that processors cannot make products that appeal to minors. For example, certain shapes, flavors, or products primarily consumed or marketed to children. Look-alike products are also prohibited. There's a common practice of taking pre-made snack foods and spraying cannabis extract on those foods. I believe our rules in Oregon prevent that from happening here. So, look-alike products are not going to be allowed under our rules. You can have a chocolate bar, but you can't have a chocolate bar that's branded and looks exactly the same as a commercially available chocolate bar. Also, DMSO, which is a compound used to break the skin barrier, essentially, for nicotine patches and those types of things, that's prohibited. Certain additives are prohibited, such as caffeine and nicotine. Also, if any edible product is being made, or if an ingredient is being made that will be later incorporated into an edible product, that must be made in a facility that's ODA certified kitchen and cannot be the same space as a restaurant. We have some particular requirements for extract processors, and an extract is defined by statute as a product that is made using certain chemical solvents, for example, butane, BHO, is a common extract, and it's differentiated from concentrates. Kind of the easy way to remember this is extract is something that can blow up. So it has extra safety requirements that we impose by rule. Those requirements are they must use a closed-loop extraction system that meets certain engineering standards, must have local fire code approval, must process in fully enclosed rooms with equipment that meets code, and must have safety equipment available for employees. Going on to the retailer is, of course, the license that sells marijuana items to the public. All products sold to the public must be tested by an OLCC licensed and OHA accredited laboratory. I think we're the only jurisdiction in the country that has this level of pre-market testing. There are certain limits on sales in order to prevent diversion on the secondary market. So those limits are listed here: 1 ounce of usable marijuana, which is flower or bud, 24 ounces for a medical card holder, 16 ounces of products in solid, 72 in liquid, 5 grams of extract or concentrate, 4 immature plants. Retailers can sell immature starts to the public for home grow purposes or for medical grow if that person is a medical card holder, and 10 seeds. We have some prohibitions for retailers. As Renee mentioned previously, local jurisdictions can adopt additional requirements using the time, place, and manner authority. Per OLCC regs, a retailer can only sell between 7 a.m. and 10 p.m., cannot provide free samples, cannot give away or sell any materials used for home extraction. For example, butane canisters used for refillable lighters are often used for home extraction. Cannot give discounts if they're conditioned on sale of another item. This is to ensure that taxes are collected efficiently and that we don't have any what they call bundling in the trade. And cannot sell items for nominal price. Every customer ID must be checked before making a sale, and everything needs to be behind the counter. There can be no self-service by the customers. We have some restrictions on advertising, and they're based off of what we've done for alcohol beverages. Principal restriction is that the advertising cannot be attractive to minors, and we define that as advertising that uses images of minors, cartoon characters, toys, or other items that are typically marketed to minors. Also, the advertising cannot promote excessive use, so displaying consumption is not allowed, encouraging use due to intoxicating effects, or encouraging rapid or excessive consumption would be prohibited under our rules. Also, our advertising rules prohibit the promotion of illegal activity, such as transporting over state lines, and we prohibit any false or misleading advertising, and that includes any kind of health claims as to therapeutic or curative effects. There are certain prohibited modes of advertising. No handbills are allowed, and also no advertising where the audience is going to be greater than 30% minors. So when advertising is sold on billboards or other medium, typically the person selling the advertisements have demographic information that's available to the purchaser. So we would expect that people purchasing advertising do so responsibly, and we're not putting up billboards across from schools and that type of thing. We also regulate packaging and labeling. Keeping with the theme of attractiveness to minors, the package cannot feature any cartoons, no consumer products, symbols, or celebrities typically marketed to minors. And again, no health claims can be made. Also, one provision that's somewhat surprising to many industry members is they cannot use the term organic. That's because the organic certification is federal, and there is no organic certification for cannabis. every item sold needs to be either in original child-resistant packaging or an exit package that is child-resistant. Child resistance is defined by a federal statute, and there's really a lot of different types of packages that meet this requirement. All label information must be unobstructed and conspicuous, and all packaging and labels must contain the universal symbol, which is on the slide there. I will also say that packaging and labeling has a pre-approval process at the OLCC, where use of any non-generic labels need to be pre-approved by our staff to make sure that they meet our requirements. It's the same with any kind of childproof packaging. They need to show proof that they have the certification that is childproof before it can be pre-approved for use. Testing laboratories. Testing laboratories must be accredited by OHA's accreditation body, which is ORLAP, and they are licensed by the OLCC. So the accreditation is a precondition for licensure. We don't handle the scientific accreditation standards, but we evaluate them for licensure the same way we would evaluate other applicants. This is required for any lab that does testing, whether it's in the recreational or the medical system. OHA sets the testing requirements, and again, we require those businesses to follow them. Certain labs perform all required tests. Other labs use subcontractors. For example, one lab might do potency and subcontract out the pesticide testing to another lab. Another important requirement is that the licensed lab must obtain the samples. The producers and processors are not allowed to provide their own samples to the labs. The licensed lab is responsible for entering test results into our cannabis tracking system. And if there is no passing test result in the cannabis tracking system, the system prevents that product from moving to market. Going forward, I think we've got continued areas for growth and improvement with the testing. And that's coordination with OHA, ensuring consistent testing methodologies, consistent reporting requirements, lab audits, and mislabeled pesticide products. We actually had a couple failures for pesticides because growers were using products which did not have all of the compounds listed on their labels. Pesticide products. Essentially, everyone who works in the recreational marijuana system is required to hold a marijuana worker permit. So that's anyone participating in possession, securing, or selling, or entering any data into the cannabis tracking system, verifying age of purchasers, or supervising those activities. If you're familiar with alcohol service permits, these look fairly similar. These permits have an application process. Permit holder must be 21 years old or older, must pass a criminal background check, and must pass a test on marijuana laws. The permits are good for 5 years, and the cost is $100. As of last week, we had issued over 16,000 permits. We had another approximately 7,500 that were approved but not yet paid for. And so far, we have had a total of 30,000 permit applications. So that'll give you some idea of the scope of employment in the marijuana industry. The cannabis tracking system, which is often referred to as the seed-to-sale tracking system, is a real-time inventory tracking software that we use to fulfill our statutory requirements. The legislature directed OLCC to develop an inventory tracking system to ensure that taxes are collected and inventory does not migrate from the legal into the illegal market. This system is important for many reasons. Firstly, it helps to supplement our limited staffing resources by aggregating data and reporting discrepancies and providing notice on potential compliance issues. It's designed to allow for more effective audits and to satisfy federal guidelines. Every plant is tracked via code. It's an RFID tag from seedling all the way through to the final sale to the consumer. It allows for efficient product recalls when we do have product recall that needs to be made, and the vendor is Metric, which is the same vendor used in Colorado. In order to prevent diversion and satisfy the requirements of the Cole memo, we drafted some fairly robust security requirements in our administrative rules. These are requirements for all licensees. 24/7 video recording in any light condition, all areas where marijuana items are present. 90-day retention on site of video recordings, and 30-day off-site backup is required. Also, we require armed alarm systems, panic buttons, and we require that all marijuana items are locked in secure locations at all times. Okay, so the next slide summarizes some of the impact from 2017 legislation. It doesn't give a blow-by-blow of all the bills. Rep. Fahey may be able to fill you in later. we'll cover impact on OLCC licensees. We had an increase in our sanctioning authority that included requiring education and also gave us authority to immediately suspend licenses when we have reason to believe there's diversion taking place. There was a bill that prohibits retailers from retaining customer information unless the customer opts in to a marketing plan or it's used for home delivery. There was a bill 1015, which allowed industrial hemp to be sold to an OLCC processor. So again, industrial hemp is separately regulated. That's regulated by Oregon Department of Agriculture. This allows that hemp kind of a window into the OLCC system, but it must be tested, tracked, and only sold to OLCC licensees. There was a provision that allows the smallest producers to process marijuana into cannabinoid concentrates under limited conditions without receiving an additional license. It allows OLCC licensees to designate themselves as exclusively medical licenses. It also allows OLCC growers who opt into a program to provide directly to medical patients. And the way that works is the grower would get an additional 10% of grow canopy for medical use. And the requirement is that 75% of the yield from that canopy must be donated for free to patients. And the remainder 25% can be sold under the same conditions as the rest of their crop. There was legislation that allowed licensees to transport and exhibit marijuana items to trade shows and similar events, such as the state fair. And there was legislation which recognizes tribal ID as acceptable ID to verify age for sales. And we did that for marijuana as well as alcohol. There was also significant impact on OHA registrants in the 2017 legislation. Specifically, OMMP registered grow sites of a certain size are required to be tracked using the OLCC's cannabis tracking system. The way that works is OLCC has authority to inspect those grow sites to ensure that the tracking is being conducted properly. We have authority to audit, but OMMP retains all other regulatory authority over those grow sites. So the only thing that's changing for these grow sites is the tracking. There's no additional security or video coverage required. Also, for those grow sites that elect into tracking, there's the ability to transfer in up to 20 pounds a year to OLCC licensees. That's 20 pounds of usable marijuana. And there's a provision there that the commission can reduce this amount if we determine that there's excess supply. There was a provision on information sharing, directing OHA to share information electronically with OLCC and Department of Revenue. There was also created a 9-member Oregon Cannabis Commission, which will be housed at the Oregon Health Authority. This will be an advisory commission dealing primarily with issues that affect medical cannabis. OLCC and OHA hotlines were created in order to allow law enforcement and members of the public an efficient means of identifying who our licensees and who our registrants are. So if they're out at a property, they can call a number and find out the licensure status very quickly. Additionally, there were 2 members added to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So we will have an additional member of the commission who will represent east of the mountains and an additional member who will represent west of the mountains. We will now be a 7-member board.
So as you can see from what Jesse, just an example of changes in 2017, one of the questions is how do we keep everyone informed of what's going on? And our number one tool is our website. To date, we have had almost 5 million visits to the www.marijuana.oregon.gov. There are resources, a lot of resources on that website. We have a business readiness guide, which I'll talk about just a little bit. We have our rules there and any rules, proposed rules as we're moving forward and our hearings. We have, we've done applicant videos where we went around the state. We videoed those and put those on the website. One of our greatest tools is our frequently asked questions. As we get questions by phone or by email or from you, we collect those and then add those to the frequently asked questions. So we try to stay on top of what folks are wanting to know. And then one of our biggest resources for us is our Gov Delivery site, which is an email alert for the latest bulletins on anything marijuana, if the rules are changing, or if something that everyone who's interested in marijuana needs to know. We've got close to 60,000 subscribers here. So one of the things that we learned as we work through this process is some of our potential applicants for marijuana licenses had never really run businesses in Oregon before. So we teamed up with the governor's office and created a business readiness guide, which has resources from all the state agencies that govern any business that runs in Oregon. And it has basic information in there and contacts. It's updated regularly. And so folks can have one place to go to make sure that they're checking off all the boxes to appropriately run their business in Oregon. We've created some infographics such as the who does what, the state agencies that are regulating. We tried to simplify it, regulating marijuana, who has responsibility for what, and what their contact information is. Those are all available on our website. We also, there was a lot of questions about what's legal, how much can you possess, how much can you buy, can you take it across state lines? So we created another infographic that a lot of our businesses are putting up in their stores and licenses as well. The next one that comes out that we're working on right now is a Go Legal campaign, and that'll be out in about the next month. And it's designed to help folks out there who maybe haven't entered our legal market, maybe are in, you know, maybe not doing things appropriately, to look at other people who are doing it now and talk about the process to get them into the legal process. So that's one of our main goals. And then the industry is potentially looking at a campaign to buy legal as well.
For the record, I'm Bill Schutte. I'm the economist with the Liquor Control Commission. I'll be doing some of the numbers here very quickly. The far left column is the number of active and approved licenses we've done so far as of September 11th, over 1,500. We have another 1,300 in a queue that have yet to be processed. Some of those have land use compatibility statements, and some do not. And a few, even 37, have been surrendered. But I want to draw attention to our last column from the right, second to last column, the 2015-17 forecast of 830 licenses. Let's just say it's safe to say the economist didn't do a very good job on that forecast when we already ended up with 1,500. The forecast for the 17-19 biennium, which went into our resourcing and our legislatively approved budget, is almost 2,000. We got the addition of almost 30 new people, or approval to hire 30 new people to help regulate these licenses. And again, as we've gone through the tiers, but we license types, but we are a fee-funded program, so the license fees must cover all the cost of administration. Average license cost is about $4,750 with a $250 application fee. Jesse made mention of the micro tiers. Those are licenses that are tried to encourage entry into the system, so they're priced exceptionally low to help produce less of an economic impact for that. A little bit about on revenue. We are not responsible for the tax collection, but we'll talk about a little bit. There's a 17% state tax on all sales of marijuana in the state, with an additional 3% that can go to local jurisdictions. Up to now, $202.5 million have been collected for, or estimated for the 17-19 biennium. Of that, 60 will be probably from last year. So the last year collections have not been distributed as of yet. They will be shortly, but the remainder of that is expected to be almost over $200 million. And again, there are no tax for sales on medical card holders. The Department of Revenue does collect the taxes. The OLCC licensed retailers report sales through the cannabis tracking system, and there's a statutory distribution similar to liquor for the distribution of that money.
Okay, so again, for the record, Jesse Sweet. I'm going to talk generally about some of the compliance issues we've been seeing and what we've been dealing with as at the agency. As Bill mentioned, we have had twice as many applications as we had expected, and that is growing daily. This creates a numbers problem for us. It's a lot of licensees to handle based on the projections that we had. I think this is a good problem to have. We want to encourage people to be in the regulated legal market. The legislature has taken steps to encourage people to be in the regulated legal market. However, this type of rapid growth is somewhat challenging for the agency. Grower licenses are particularly complicated. Every outdoor grower is different. It's the largest license category. They're often located in very remote geography. It could take 3-4 hours from the nearest field office just to reach some of these locations. They're more likely to change their operational practices. What we've seen as these businesses scale up in their first, second year, they're looking to grow. All that growth requires additional processing of forms and inspections by our staff. Growers also represent the largest risk of diversion. That's where the most product is at one time, and it's a risk due to that fact alone. Our enforcement efforts are evolving. There's incentive to divert and invert product illegally, especially if there's oversupply. If a grower can get $1,000 per pound for their product in the legal market, and they can get $3,000 a pound by shipping it across the country, there's always going to be an incentive there for diversion. We've also run into some logistical problems as far as locating facilities to seize and store product when seizure is required. We have new classes of cases. At this point, we know liquor pretty well, but every marijuana case is new. So For example, we are now ordering that product be destructed for pesticide failures. We've never done things like that before. Similarly, product recalls. We have packaging and labeling oversight, as I described earlier. And there are difficult legal issues simply because this is also new and there's no established protocol. We're taking a prevention and compliance approach. I touched on the security requirements previously with cameras and alarms. We also require any time that marijuana is transferred from license to license, it's accompanied by a manifest describing that transport. We use the cannabis tracking system as a tool for investigation. So it can flag a lot of things that we need to look into, including a product that appears without source, improper transfers, retailers not reporting their sales timely, weight mismatches, and also we can use it as a tool to make sure that daily possession limits are not being oversold. We are also out in the field. We take a proactive role in doing routine inspections and, again, using the cannabis tracking system as a tool that flags us when inspections are needed. We respond to complaints and investigate reports of criminal activity and administrative violations. What we found, frankly, is that the compliant growers are our best source of information. The folks who have made an investment in doing it lawfully are losing their patience with the folks who are not doing it lawfully. And we coordinate with local governments and local law enforcement to prevent and identify violations. Some of the ways in which we achieve that law enforcement coordination, when we uncover criminal activity that goes beyond the scope of our licensees, we refer that to local law enforcement. Minor decoys and compliance checks will be handled much the same way that they're handled for our liquor operations. We also have a public safety education and enforcement committee. That committee was comprised of top law enforcement officials from around the state, tasked with discussing coordination issues and intersection between the legal and illegal markets. There's also that committee, which met last year, made recommendations for a DUII study. The recommendations essentially were that we do not adopt a presumptive level of intoxication for THC in the way that some other states have. So the recommendation, it was essentially status quo as far as Oregon DUII for cannabis goes. Also, very recently, we announced plans to co-locate OSP detectives in our Medford office. These will continue to be OSP employees, not OLCC employees, but by having them co-located in the same office, we're hoping that we can get real seamless collaboration where it's just a file being handed over from one desk to the other. Again, that's to help to bring in illegal grows, illegal processing, and illegal diversion from our system, and to help aid in the investigation and prosecution by local law enforcement. The cannabis tracking system, as I discussed previously, it serves a number of purposes. It helps to track inventory at the very first instance when medical growers and other medical registrants are transferring to OLCC licensure and bringing product with them. As I mentioned before, OHA registrants who do not elect to apply for OLCC licensure are also going to be in this tracking system beginning in July of next year. So the process there is on December 1st of this year, OMMP growers are going to have to make a declaration to OHA, and they will have to either opt into this tracking system or reduce their plant counts below 13 plants. This is also going to be a requirement for any remaining OMMP dispensaries or OMMP processors. And OHA fees will pay the cost of the tracking, and OLCC's cost for our activities will be covered by the tax revenue. So key task ahead of us, in order to pull this off, we need to revise the cannabis tracking system software in order to accommodate these OMMP growers. We need to develop rules, processes, and procedures, which we're going to do hand-in-hand with OHA. We need to hire and train additional staff because we're getting a new population here of potentially thousands of OMMP growers that will be coming over to this tracking system. We'll also be engaging in statewide outreach starting in the beginning of next year in order to educate this community about the tracking system and how to effectively use it.
So say that this is the last slide.
Okay. So our moving forward slide here is the very last marijuana slide before we switch to alcohol. And it just gives some general ideas of what we're going to be looking at as we go into the next year. Licensing and renewal processing, we made a really big push to get everybody licensed in the first instance, and now we've had a year in the program and we need to get everybody renewed. We need to implement the CTS for medical registrants, as I just described. We need to continue our compliance and enforcement activities. We've really switched from a licensing mode to a compliance mode as the system gets up and running. That means investigations that were triggered by a cannabis tracking system, and that also means taking things through the administrative hearings process. We have an in-house administrative hearings unit where we utilize lay representatives to do all of our administrative hearings work. We're also helping to coordinate for consistent criminal enforcement, and that's with local and state law enforcement, as well as prosecuting attorneys. We are monitoring supply versus demand. We have a report that is due to the legislature. We also have ability to reduce canopy sizes and take other actions if we find that we have oversupply. And there's really two separate questions here when we talk about oversupply of cannabis in Oregon. There's the question of, is Oregon as a state generally oversupplied with cannabis? And then there's the question of, is the OLCC licensed system oversupplied with cannabis? And we're only focusing on that second question. We're not looking at supply in the medical market or in the illegal market. Social consumption is an issue that has received a lot of attention, but so far we do not have any legal mechanism to allow marijuana clubs or consuming in any kind of public space or event. And you know, tourism goes with that. We have quite a number of information technology projects on our plate, both ongoing and coming up. Continued refinement to our application and licensing system, as well as our cannabis tracking system. Online registration for OHA grows who are being tracked. That will mostly happen on the OHA side, but we need to figure out the data handoff from them to us. We need to continue to do API connections with point of sale systems. These allow retailer point of sale systems to talk seamlessly to the metric system. We need to get some better systems together for reports and public records, data utilization for enforcement and electronic records management. We're also working on a computer-aided dispatch for OSP and a field mobility program, which will allow greater connectivity for our staff in the field. This concludes the marijuana portion of our slides. Chair Holvey, I don't know if you would like to break it up and take marijuana questions, or if you would like me to keep going into alcohol.
I think let's go to alcohol, unless there's a burning question from anybody. I mean, my ultimate question is, what are you going to do with marijuana-infused beer? It's not possible, right?
Chair Holby.
There was a slide that said no infusions. Or
there is no marijuana infused beer.
Okay, so let's move on. To the
Okay, so let me catch my breath for a second, and we'll go into alcohol. So our history here with alcohol in Oregon, in 1844, we had the distinction of passing the first prohibition law in the United States, which we quickly repealed in 1845. Skipping forward to 1933, when prohibition was repealed, this legislature created the OLCC in a special session with the goals of providing revenue and keeping alcohol abuse to a lower level. In the intervening 84 years, the laws and the regulations have evolved to guide production and sales. Our current focus is on preventing access to minors and public safety, specifically sales to visibly intoxicated persons. And we are continually adapting to help support Oregon businesses and to keep our regulations flexible to foster economic development. In 2016, we had a major investment in our warehouse conveyor system and software to increase shipping capacity for distilled spirits. We went from shipping out of one door in the warehouse to three, I believe. So basically, the regulation of alcohol, we have two systems. We have a license system for beer, wine, and cider, and we have a warehouse system for distilled spirits. We license businesses that manufacture, distribute, and sell alcohol. We issue permits to alcohol servers. We manage and distribute distilled spirits through our warehouse and through our retail liquor agents. We regulate businesses that sell and serve alcohol. We provide public information. And we collect all taxes for beer and wine. We also have the administrative hearings unit, which I mentioned previously, as well as field staff inspectors who visit bars on a regular basis. So as in almost all states, the three-tier system is the defining characteristic of alcohol regulation here in Oregon. The three tiers consist of manufacturers, breweries, brew pubs, wineries, and distilleries, wholesalers, and retailers, both on-premise retailers like bars and restaurants and off-premise retailers like grocery and convenience stores. So that's the basic setup. What you'll find when you look a little closer is that many of our license types exist partially in one tier and partially in another. For example, brew pubs and wineries, they both produce alcohol beverages and sell the same beverages directly to the public. Which brings me to the next slide, tied house laws. Tied house laws are exist in both federal and state law, and the essential concept is that the same business is prevented from selling at both wholesale and retail. That is the rule. As I mentioned previously, there are many exceptions in Oregon statutory law to this rule. And they're quite complicated, and that's what keeps me employed, I suppose. In addition to the prohibition of selling at both wholesale and retail, there's also a prohibition of any licensee or entity in the wholesale or manufacturing tier from providing financial assistance to the retail tier. So this means things like credit and volume discounts. Like unlike other items in a grocery store where General Mills is going to pay slotting fees to get their cereal on the shelf or give volume discounts to get their product into the store, alcohol beverage manufacturers cannot do that. It's got to be the same price to everybody. There's no credit, and there's no warehousing of product on behalf of the retailer. As I mentioned before, beer and wine are regulated and sold differently than spirits in Oregon. We are a control state for spirits, which means the state controls the sale of spirits. Wine and beer are sold through licensed state entities, and spirits are sold through the state-controlled wholesale and retail system. We have a bailment warehouse all of the spirits sold in Oregon go through our warehouse. We do not pay the manufacturer for those spirits until they leave our shipping door. At that point, they go out to our retail liquor agents, where the state floors the inventory cost and pays the retail liquor agents a commission on their sales. The license system, all other alcohol products, beer, wine, and cider, must be handled exclusively by licensees of the commission. So that's manufacturer, wholesaler, and retailers again. And we work with all licensees to improve and modernize their business practices through rulemaking, education, and the legislative process. The next slide gives an example of some of the things that we've done in order to work with businesses and help keep our system modern and flexible. We allow growlers just about everywhere. We have Sunday and holiday sales, distillery tasting rooms, alcohol sales at food carts, movie theaters, and farmer markets. I would like to call everyone's attention to OregonLiquorSearch.com. This website will give you the inventory of every bottle of distilled spirits available for sale in the state. So if you're looking for a particular bottle, you can just type it in and it will show you your nearest liquor store where you can locate that product. We have bottle sales from distilleries. We've supported a robust mixology culture. We've got flexible tasting rules. We even have a distillery outlet at Portland Airport. Two things we've done very recently, we've relaxed our rules on happy hour advertising and tap labeling.
So again, back to the numbers. Again, a comparison of the alcohol license permits to the marijuana ones. Over 15,000 alcohol licenses in the state of Oregon. You remember there was over 1,500 marijuana licenses. Probably very familiar to you, on-premise licenses, restaurants and bars, off-premise licenses are grocery and convenience stores that only sell wine and beer. Wineries, that is a quite high number for wineries, but it also includes things like wine warehouses and other areas that store wine. Anywhere that alcohol is transferred to prior to the point of sale has to be on a licensed premise. Brew pubs, distributors, and over almost 9,000 special event licenses every year. That's where somebody wants to have a concert or a festival, and we issue them a one-day or two-day or three-day permit to do that. And almost 160,000 alcohol service permits. The license types, here's a list of the fees. I won't go through all of them, but they are fairly low. We have some of the lower license fees in the country, ranging from $100 on the low end for the grocery store convenience stores up to probably the highest is $500 for a brewery and a brew pub or brewery. And then most bars, restaurants pay $400 a year. Again, the slide, the gross revenues coming from alcohol sources, the great bulk of that comes from distilled spirits, almost $1.31 billion. We get a smaller amount, $38 million in the biennium from beer and wine taxes and about $13 million in liquor licensing fees. We do have a forecast of gross liquor sales. You'll see that on this one you see 2 points for the 17-19 biennium. $1.39 billion. Legislature added 3% to our forecast, talking about related to our expansion. I'll talk about that later. Right now, it's tracking closer to the $1.31 billion, but with the additional stores coming to the state, we think it's very possible that we could hit that $1.39 billion mark. But again, this is we get the sales monthly, and we update this forecast monthly as well. And here's a distribution of that revenue. The great majority of it, almost 56%, goes to the general fund, $326 million in upcoming biennium. Cities, counties, we do have a 2 cent a gallon fee that we collect for the Oregon Wine Board. That'll be about $660,000 in this upcoming biennium that goes directly to them. And the other ones are done by or distributed by statute. Again, we are the third largest source revenue source for the general fund and the second largest for cities and counties. So a little bit about beer and wine tax collection. We have excise taxes for beer and wine. It's taxed at 8 cents a gallon for beer, 67 cents a gallon for table wine. Again, 65 cents of that is the actual wine tax, and 2 cents of that goes to the Oregon Wine Board. Beer and wine taxes are collected mostly at the wholesale tier of the system, as Jesse was describing. Wholesalers and distributors pay about 90% of all these taxes. Some of these taxes, are, such as from winery, are paid by wineries and brew pubs, about 10%. Total tax collections are about $18 million a year from both wine and beer taxes. A little bit about the model of distilled spirits, about how we operate the warehouse and how the funding is arranged in there. This is our famous bottle. Our average bottle sold out of the warehouse is about $17. Of that bottle, about half of it, 49%, is the cost of goods, the manufacturer's cost. The next tier in there is almost 8.93%, which is the percentage of commission that goes to our liquor store operators. We do carry the credit card cost, about 1%, or about $12 million a biennium is in that bottle as well. And then that second to upper tier, 4% for the OLCC operating expense, which not only includes the warehouse, but covers the cost of all the enforcement, licensing, and administration and distribution functions as well. And with a 37% net profit to state, cities, counties, and the general fund.
I'm going to go really quickly through these next few slides. So let's go to the next one, Bill. So this is how distilled spirits flow through Oregon in the OLCC system. They come in through brokers, manufacturers, and distillers. They're listed with those products that they sell are listed with us. We have about 4,500 products that we distribute through our system. About 2,400 of those are actually housed in our warehouse, and the rest can be gotten by special order. We have one main distribution center. We actually have two warehouses. As Jesse mentioned before, the product that's in our warehouses are vendor-owned. We don't have to pay for it until it actually goes out the door. And what that does for us is it saves us about $90 million in product that we would have to pay for in order to keep our stores stocked regularly. We have about 10 to 12 total turns in our warehouse of all the products in our warehouse each year. Our liquor store agents actually choose what's sold in their stores, but we work with them. Our district managers work with them and show, you know, they look at their data, they show what's selling in other places, and so we help them with that. The average retail value, as Jesse mentioned before, once it goes out of our doors, then the state purchases it. OLCC floors that inventory. That means we own the inventory. The agent does not pay for that inventory. The value in an average store is about $235,000, and the value of all the products that we have out in all the stores throughout the state is about $95 million. The OLCC partners with carriers. We pay for the shipping. We do up to 3 shippings per store per week, but you know, in eastern Oregon or in farther parts of Oregon, that's probably 1. It's usually the metro area that has a more regular, they sell more products, they have more shipments. The retail stores, they sell to consumers, and they sell to licensees, bars, and restaurants. The licensees receive a 5% discount on that product, but the liquor agents receive a full commission on the full retail value, but actually in the compensation formula, they get a little less for paying for selling to a licensee. And as we move forward and looking at agent compensation, that might be something that we look at. So our retail managers also help support those stores in their activities. So our agents are They track their spirit sales daily. That comes in electronically to the agency. They are paid their commission monthly, and they also have their base commission that's paid monthly. Well.
So we'll finish up quickly here, just a little bit about liquor store agents. They are commission selects all the retail store agents in the state. They are under contract. They have a specific compensation formula, which includes a base commission rate times a variable compensation rate, 6.5% of the licensee sales or sales to bars and restaurants, and 8% of the consumer sales. As Renee said, we do floor the inventory. OLCC does pay for the credit card fees, about $12 million a year, and that's part of our budget. OLCC also pays for shipping delivery costs. And the agents need to, they build and maintain and rent the buildings, purchase fixtures, hire and train staff, and they are allowed a retirement and resignation buyout from any new agent that wants to come in and take over the store. There is the selection and recruitment process. They have to present to us real legitimate business proposals, including capital investment and financing. We look at their retail business experience, knowledge of the alcohol industry. We also considered location impact on existing agents. That's especially important with the new expansion we're looking at, convenience, and they also need to present to us an estimate of their sales and revenue. Again, where the stores are distributed through the state, right now we have 268 stores, 94 what they call exclusive, which are primarily liquor only, and we have 175 where they're classified as non-exclusive, which sell liquor and other things, although in the Portland metro area, that now includes liquor plus beer and wine. In addition to that, 98 distillery outlets where the distilleries are allowed to sell out of a facility or a facility they designate. A little bit about retail expansion, why we went into it to begin with. 30 years ago, there was one liquor store for every 12,000 Oregonians. In 2015, that ratio had climbed to one liquor store for every 16,000 Oregonians. There are some communities, especially in the metro areas, where there's one store for 29,000 people. Looking at this expansion, and I'll talk a little bit about where we're at in that, we are expecting a 3% increase in forecasted revenue at $39.4 million, which would result in $17 million in distributed revenue. And part of our budget request, what we did receive, was we got the addition of one district manager and a business analyst to support that expansion. Here's the list of the expansion. Area 1 was a Portland metro area where we had 14 new locations approved. Second phase earlier this year was in the Lynn County, Benton County area where we had 6 new locations approved. Right now we are in Eastern Oregon, Region 3. We currently have 32 applications that we're looking to approve up to maybe 10 or 12. We don't know yet, depending on the quality of the applications, by the end of October. And then just moving forward, again, we're looking at the retail expansion. As Renee mentioned, agents' compensation has always been an issue. We're looking at the cost of operations, credit card fees, whether that should be on the state, or we could transfer those perhaps to the agents themselves with appropriate compensation to do that with. Commission sales for licensees, perhaps. Policy questions. Capital budgeting. We did complete a very large capital project replacing a major part of the roof of our warehouses. Unfortunately, they're not all done. There's a smaller portion that probably will have to be done looking into the future. We are also looking to increase the number of minor decoy premises visits. And as with marijuana, the information technology, with being challenged with that. But with the adaptation and implementation of recreational marijuana, looking at some of the online systems, we're looking at those for alcohol as well with online service permits and liquor licensing. There was a bill that's requiring us to do electronic beer and wine tax filing to be completed by the end of 2019, electronic records management. We still have a lot of paper forms in our office, so IT is one of the big things that we are looking to move forward for in the next biennium. And with that, I'll close.
So at this point, Oh, let's go to the next slide. I just, you know, one of our missions, as we went through the marijuana program, we were focused totally on alcohol before, and so we worked with our agency and came up with an approach that we think makes a lot of sense, and that's to help businesses be successful at the same time we keep our communities safe and viable. So we're happy to take any questions. A lot of material.
Thank you. I thought it important for, you know, myself and probably for other committee members really to take a step back and looking at OLCC globally as we face a lot of issues, you know, in the legislature. And, of course, we're a bifurcated system somewhat, so some committees have purview over some subject matter, and OLCC flows in and out of this committee quite regularly on different topics, and expect that to probably continue off and on. But I really appreciate this overview because I think it helps us understand your framework and helps inform us on questions and challenges that may come forward. I mean, this really wasn't meant to be something where we're going to dive into the weeds and ask you specific issues. I really wanted an educational piece, and you accomplished that for me. And I don't know if there's any questions that anybody specifically has, but I'm sure. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for such a comprehensive overview of marijuana and alcohol. I had a question. I'm interested in occupational licensure, and so I wanted to ask about the purpose of the criminal background check for marijuana workers, specifically from the standpoint of if you had a previous, if you have history with marijuana and you were arrested for it and you were in the criminal justice system, and now you want to be a legal worker in the system, help me kind of work through that.
Absolutely. Jesse will do that for you.
No.
Chair Holby, Representative Bynum, thank you for your question. The statutory requirements for eligibility for a marijuana worker permit are fairly clear when it comes to prior marijuana offenses. Unless the prior marijuana offense is very recent, it is not going to be considered as a disqualification. Additionally, only felonies are going to be considered disqualification. So I may not be citing this entirely correctly from memory, but I believe we can only look at felony offenses and specifically marijuana offenses within the last 2 years from the application. And as to the purpose, you know, one of the purposes of the Cole memo, which is the federal doctrine that guides the state system here, is that is to prevent individuals who've been involved in illegal activity and specifically organized crime from entering the legitimate market. And the criminal background check is really one of the best tools that we have to achieve that purpose.
Again, thank you so much for your putting this together for us. I do appreciate it. So with that, we're going to move on to our next presentation, which is an update on the Oregon SAVES program resulting from some legislation passed. And we have from the Treasurer's Office, I believe, and Lisa Messina, Joel Metlin, maybe I should put my glasses on, it would help. Salim Narani and Joyce Damonin. Boy, I apologize if I messed up your names. As we're trying to stay on schedule here, I appreciate you're moving through the program, and if there are any questions, we'll take them up at the end of your presentation.
Perfect. Thank you. So good afternoon, Rep. Holvey and members of the, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I think it's going to be tough to be spicier than marijuana and alcohol, but we'll give them a run for their money. So for the record, I'm Lisa Messina, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Saves Program. For a number of you, this will be a refresher of information that you're already familiar with the program. For some of you, it might be a little bit new. And our mission is to provide an update on the program in the early days of launch and to give you some community perspective around that. So I'll start with a few highlights of the program and what it is. So why has Oregon put this program into place in the first place? So we have as many as a million Oregonians that don't have the ability to save at work, save for retirement at work. We know that Social Security on its own is not enough. And we know that people are significantly more likely, so 15 times more likely to save if this is available to them through their workplace. So who is the program for? So Oregon Saves is facilitated by our employers in Oregon, so specifically employers who do not offer a retirement savings program to their employee. We have worked very hard to keep the responsibilities of employers quite light and quite simple and straightforward. So you'll see that their focus is on registering the company, providing a bit of employee information, and then executing the payroll deduction that allows employees to save. From an employee standpoint, the program has been very inclusive. So it is oriented toward folks who are 18 years old or older and working in Oregon with an earned income in the state. Some of the key characteristics of the program, at the heart of the program is an IRA account. So the default type is a Roth IRA. The program uses automatic enrollment, so folks are opting out if this isn't what they want to do. But if they don't opt out, they're automatically enrolled. And then, of course, we provide a variety of choice. So let's just spend a minute talking about how the program works. And these are the basics. So I already talked a little bit about the Roth IRA account being the core of the program. People are saving their own money for themselves. The standard pathway is that folks are saving 5%, escalating to 10% over time. That from an investment standpoint, the first $1,000 is invested into a capital preservation fund. After that, funds go into a target retirement, or the savings go into a target retirement fund, which I like to describe as a canoe. It carries you to your retirement, and you don't have to hop out and change investments all the time. And I'll just hit the next page. So from a choice standpoint, a number of different choices. So obviously save more or save less or opt out of the program altogether. From an investment standpoint, the investment menu is deliberately very, very simple. So again, the heart of the program is target retirement funds that invest differently for you based on your anticipated time to retirement. We add to that capital preservation so that you can save but invest with safety. And on the other side, we've also included a growth fund for folks who'd like to have that. The program, as it matures, is to be funded out of fees applied against accounts. So the administrative fees are netted from returns essentially continuously, and they're about 1% currently, with the target of reducing them over time as the program achieves scale. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Joel Metlin to talk a little bit about how it's going, and this is maybe the fun part. So,
thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Metlin with Oregon State Treasury, and I handle the public engagement and working hand-in-hand with our employers and employees on making sure this program rolls out well and achieves all the goals that it was set out to do. So we took a very deliberate and thoughtful approach to rolling this out. We didn't want to roll it out to a million people all at once. We wanted to take our time and make sure that we were getting the pieces right. So we decided to start the program actually with a series of pilots. We split it into two pilots. One was a very small initial pilot, basically just to test and make sure that everything was working. But we had 11 employers join us, go through the system, do the registration process, set up payroll contributions, hand their employees information, see how it worked, make sure that we have a good, tight feedback loop with them to see what we can improve and what we can work on. That pilot is up and running now, and it's doing very well, and I'll go into numbers in a second. And after the first pilot, we've moved on to a second one, which is larger, and it has a slightly different purpose. The first one was small. It only had a handful of employers. The second one is much bigger. We are looking for a more diverse range of employers. We wanted diversity in terms of their size. So in the first pilot, we had mostly small employers. In the second pilot, we have employers ranging in size from 2 employees to over 500. And they are also very diverse in where they are in the state, in how they do business, what industry they're in, and how they do things behind the scenes in terms of their payroll contributions. Do they do it in-house? Do they outsource it to the local vendor? Or do they use the big folks like ADP or Paychex? We wanted to see how it would work in each of those circumstances to make sure that it's going to work just as well for the employer with 2 employees as it is for the one with 500. So at the first pilot, we're starting to get our first real numbers to tell us, you know, how is it going? Our 11 employers had 158 total employees, and the numbers there show you that we have about a 23% opt-out rate. So the great majority of folks decided to stay in the program. Most of those people chose automatic enrollment and stuck with the 5% savings rate, went into the standard investment options. We haven't seen a lot of movement over the last 2 months in terms of their participation. People that stayed in have pretty much stayed in. A few people have made different choices. Some started low. They started with a savings rate maybe of 1 or 2% and then brought it up. A couple of people started a little higher and then brought it down, but most people stayed at the standard rate. On average, they're contributing about $70 per pay period. And of those 121 people in just over 2 months have saved more than $30,000. And it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but for 121 people, I think that is a lot of money. And we're very excited that those folks now have that money set on their own individual IRAs that they now have available for retirement. So that's very good news. Pilot 2, we have 36 employers and about 2,000 employees. They're currently in their 30-day period where they get to choose if they want to participate. The payroll deduction should start sometime in September or October, and we will have more numbers on what the participation rates look like for that as those payroll deduction dates start. But right now, it's looking very similar to Pilot 1, that most folks are getting ready to be automatically enrolled and stick with the standard savings options. So the pilots are there for us really to figure out what's working, what needs improvement, what can we prioritize prior to the statewide rollout later this year. So we've been actually in person with a lot of these employers, sitting down, watching them go through the process, hearing what they're saying, seeing what barriers they might be running into, taking copious notes. Actually, that first picture is us taking notes at Square Deal Lumber in Springfield. Because we really want to learn from their experience. It's one thing to design a system. It's another thing to be able to see your actual end user use it, learn from them, figure out what's really important to them to make sure that this is very easy on the employer side and that the employees have the information that they need on their side to make informed decisions. And as you can see, we've had pretty good feedback from these folks. They are not shy about telling us their opinions, and that's been wonderful. And our favorite quote, of course, is there at the bottom, which is, well, that was pretty painless. And that's our goal, really, right? We want this to be a simple thing for businesses so that there's just that benefit to the employer that they have this retirement savings option available for their employees. And then there's that, obviously, the benefit to the employee of having something through their work that is simple and is automatic and easy. And therefore, the default becomes that they are saving and hopefully having a better financial future.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Salim Narani, a small business owner, a liquor agent as well, volunteer and executive committee member of AARP Oregon, and vice chair of Senior Services Advisory Committee Cascades West. Oregon Saves is a great program, not only for a small business owner like myself, but also for a vast majority of workers in Oregon who do not have access to a company-sponsored 401k program. I've spent the last 25-plus years building small businesses and operating in Oregon. While I attribute my current retail business success and growth to my 11 loyal employees, I haven't been able to provide them with a retirement plan. First and foremost, I couldn't afford the cost of establishing a 401k-style plan for my employees. Financial services firms do not offer affordable products to small employers like myself because it's hard for them to make money on small accounts. I have been a strong supporter of Oregon Saves, a program for people who do not have a retirement savings option at work. Oregon Saves has helped to ease the retirement fears I have as an entrepreneur. Like many small business owners, I have been concerned about my employees' financial security and retirement. One-third of retirees count on Social Security for 90% or more of their retirement income. And 29% of Americans aged 55 to 64 have no retirement savings at all. We all know just relying on Social Security for retirement income is not enough. It was never designed to be and is never going to be. More than half of people living in America do not have access to either a 401k or some form of saving for retirement. I'm not the only one who thinks state-based private sector retirement plan like Oregon Saves is a great tool for small businesses. Similar plans have garnered support from small business owners across the country. I'm proud to support Oregon Saves and be part of the pilot rollout because it will help my employees be more successful in saving for retirement and live a life with dignity, choice, and worry-free and truly enjoy the golden years of retirement. I thank you for the opportunity of being able to share my thoughts with you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm Joyce Tabonin, the Communication Director for AARP Oregon. And we came here originally in 2013 because we had a huge problem in our state, which was we had about half of workers were not saving for retirement. And AARP were meeting people every day that were desperate to know what they could do. And for people who are already retired, we may not be able to do enough to help them. But it made it clear to all of us working in advocacy that nothing was being done for these smaller sector workers. And so in 2015, the legislature did actually approve legislation creating the Oregon Retirement Savings Board that AARP worked on in 2013 and 2015. And I'm just here to say that we are so delighted with what's happening. The staff has done everything that the legislation set out to do. They've met all of their targets. They've designed a program that's thoughtful and thorough. And I really believe that this program moving forward is going to really reduce that retirement savings gap. I think one of the really fabulous things about this program, number one, we did start people out at 18 and not just you'd have to be 35 or you have to work so many months or something like that. Everybody's in, and it goes with you from job to job, and you can work in a small business or you can work temporarily and you can still save for retirement. So we really feel this is going to make a difference, and hopefully in a few years we will not be seeing these rates of poverty of seniors. So AARP is continuing to support Treasury and the Oregon Save staff in any way that we can, and we will continue to advocate for the success of this program, and we urge the legislature to partner with us in making sure that all Oregonians can retire with dignity. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, that concludes our comments, but we're happy to take any questions that you might have.
Do we have any questions? Representative Bynum.
It's an easy one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what does the envelope look like that an employer will receive? I have not received an envelope. I have not received an email to certify. And you know, when we talk about, like, we heard the Attorney General's office talk about fraud a lot of the envelopes that I get as an employer look fraudulent. So I just want to know, what should I be looking for? Haven't seen it.
So Chair Holvey and Representative Bynum, I'd like to maybe direct that question to Joel, who works on our outreach and engagement, to talk about how we're working with employers.
Yes. Thank you for the question, Representative Bynum. We are rolling this out just as we rolled out with the pilot in stages. We're going to be rolling it out to businesses statewide in stages as well. On the screen, you'll see the different waves that we've designed this. It's actually going to be rolled out over the course of about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is to just make sure that we are doing it in a way that allows us to provide the best level of service to employers and employees. So we're starting with the largest businesses first, so those with 100 or more employees. Mm-hmm. They should have received their first notice end of July, early August. We sent actually a notice directly from Treasury to say, hey, this is a real thing. This is coming. Look out for the notice. It'll tell you, it'll give you instructions on what's coming. And then we sent out a notice directly from Oregon Saves. That's what's on the envelope, to say, hey, here is this program. In a few months, you're going to be asked to go online and either exempt out if you already offer a plan or register for the program. It was just sort of our early notice to make sure that people are hearing about it. What we're doing now in the meantime is doing some direct outreach to those businesses, calling up folks to see, did you get your notice? Did it go to the right person? Trying to be proactive about it. So then when it comes to that November 15th deadline, we've tried to reach out to everyone we think will need to facilitate the program to make sure they understand it and understand the impact on them and what they need to do. And the same with the folks that will just need to exempt out. For those folks, it should be a very simple and quick process. I followed up personally with a few large businesses just to ask, how did it go? What was it like? And the feedback is it took a couple minutes and it was easy, and which is what we want to hear. But if there's any issues, we want to identify those now so that we have a little bit of time to figure out exactly if there are any issues, how can we help, how can we serve these folks so that, you know, there's not a mad rush there at the end. And then, you know, we are starting with the largest employers because hopefully they have some folks in their HR department, or they work with one of the large payroll providers that has a system in place to make it a little simpler for folks to handle. We're saving the smallest employers for last until 2019, 2020, because we really want to make sure that it's that self-service system that's super simple for them. And if there's anything that's difficult or needs to be worked on, we have some time to come up with innovative solutions so that it matches their business model and they don't have to come up with a new way of doing business just to accommodate our program. So those businesses in the first wave will receive another notice on October 15th that'll say, okay, now it's time. Here's your passcode. Here's the website you go to. Here's the phone number if you need any assistance. Here's the website. We also have two field reps that will be in Oregon going around talking to employer groups, doing trainings, just really trying to help facilitate it for those, especially if they have any issues, then we can start working on that and help people get through the process.
Thank you. I appreciate the way you're rolling this out. It really it looks well thought out and obviously designed to enable you to react and address any issues that come up or challenges. And so, I mean, my question is, have you seen potential challenges in your pilot projects that you anticipate you're going to have to address going forward? Have any problems presented themselves, or has it just been all smooth sailing?
Chair Holby, thank you for the question. No, it's not been all smooth sailing, and that's why we're doing the pilots. We want to identify areas where people get hung up in the process. You know, we come upon interesting circumstances where, you know, maybe we don't have a single email address for any of the employees, so sending them notice, we're going to have to send them all notice by regular mail. You're going to have to follow up to make sure they're getting their notice, because we want to make sure that people have the information that they need to make a decision about this. We're refining the process for what happens when we're trying to set up accounts for folks, and maybe some of the data that the employer provided about the individuals doesn't quite match up. Maybe the name and Social Security number don't match. What's the right process to protect people's identity, but to also follow up and make sure that we have what we need in order to legally set up an account for them. We're refining all of that, and that's why we're doing the pilot, to see what it's like with real life people, make sure that we have a process with, you know, just we have a small sample of people here where we can have that hands-on experience where we can talk them through it. They can give us advice on, you know, as an employer, this is the way I prefer to handle business. This is what makes sense for my employees. Here's the things that you may have. The example is we have a staffing company in the pilot where they have really high rates of turnover. And if you have a program like this where you constantly need to enroll people and disenroll them because they move on after a month of work, you know, that's a slightly different circumstance than somebody who works for a company for a couple of years. So we want to make sure that there's an automated way for people to be enrolled and get taken off so that for the staffing company, that's not a lot of administrative work behind the scenes. And so we're working on all those things. We're prioritizing what we can fix by wave one. And especially knowing, you know, what are the types of industries, what are the types of businesses in wave one? So what sort of are the priority things that we can work on to improve in the system? And I think the key is that this is never a static program or a static product. The idea is that we're doing it waves so that we always have the opportunity to continue to improve it and make it better for the end users.
Well, thank you. I appreciate all the efforts that have gone in this. I was sort of excited about this program when this legislation passed, and it sounds like it's off to a good start. Please keep us informed if you run into issue areas that you need the legislature to help out with in the future, and good luck. And I suppose if any of us have questions or employers in our areas that are having problems, we'll be referring them back to you. And again, thank you, and just keep us informed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
From that follow-up program, we're going to move on to a presentation from Department of Consumer and Business Services around insurance claims, the process and remedies available to consumers. It's an issue area that comes in and out of the legislature from time to time, and I won't say it's the easiest subject matter to tackle, but I'm sure our presenters will do a good job of it. So with that, Gene Strait, Rick Blackwell, and Tashia Sample.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Jean Strait, and I'm the Acting Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services. And so,
congratulations and welcome.
Yeah, thank you. So I will give just a high-level overview of the agency, and then Rick and Tasha will take it and talk to you more about the specific details. So Oregon's DCBS is Oregon's largest business regulatory and consumer protection agency. Our mission is to protect and serve Oregonians, consumers, and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state of Oregon. Our key goals are consumer and worker protection, healthy and competitive markets, informed businesses and consumers, satisfied customers, financial soundness, operational excellence, and engaged staff. So our agency is made up of five program areas: Workers' Comp Division, Oregon OSHA, Building Codes, and I'm getting, can you click on the slides? So I think about three in.
There.
So Building Codes Division, Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, and then the Division of Financial Regulation. So financial regulation, their mission is protecting Oregonians' access to fair products and services through education, regulation, and consumer assistance. The division ensures that insurance companies, banks, and credit unions are financially sound, Oregonians are treated fairly as policyholders and beneficiaries, all financial insurance mortgage professionals are held to high standards, and rates are reasonable in relation to the benefits provided by an insurance policy. So that's a high-level overview of our agency, and now Rick will take over and talk about the specifics.
Thank you, Jean. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager, the Division in Financial Regulation. With me is Tasha Sample, so Senior Policy Analyst within in the policy section. So we'll go ahead and talk about the consumer protection functions within the insurance code, with an eye towards the claim settlement process and how we can be helpful to consumers. So our mission, DFR's mission, I think complements DCBS in that we protect Oregonians' access to fair products and services through education, regulation, and customer assistance. So As we look out for the insurance buying public as a whole, we do that in a number of ways. We, in the terms of product regulation, we're trying to look at the contracts up front to make sure that they're fair for consumers before they ever buy the policies. A team of consumer advocates actually works to directly assist customers with those products once there's questions about claim settlement. With insurance institutions, we audit and supervise the companies, making sure that their financial position is sound. After all, an insurance company that's unable to pay claims will not protect consumers at all. So it's really important that those secondary impacts on consumer protection are looked at through the financial process. When there's times we suspect that there's a broader violation, either insurer or market-wide violation may be occurring, my colleagues in the compliance section do examinations to determine if there's a violation that's occurred. And then finally, if and when we've determined that a violation's occurred, my colleagues in the enforcement section will apply the Administrative Procedures Act and the tools available in the code to assure compliance. So for today's presentation, I'm going to focus primarily on consumer advocacy, compliance, and enforcement, but we'll briefly touch on insurance institutions and product reg. I do have a few slides on the trade practice statutes themselves. I'll briefly go over those. But Mr. Chair, I don't know if you want to entertain questions during the presentation or not. That's up to you.
Based on time, the answer is no.
Very good. Thank you.
If we have questions, they'll be at the end.
Okay. Thank you. So consumer advocates handle complaints and inquiries for Morgan consumers. I think for the most part, they are directly dealing with claim settlement practices every day, right? So if someone is being denied a claim, delays in payments, unsatisfactory offers, et cetera, so those folks are the ones on the front lines taking calls and assisting consumers with those questions directly. They use their knowledge of multiple lines of insurance and by business practices to analyze and resolve these, most of the time, complex issues. So you can see from the slide that we do have posting significant results. So in 2016, out of the nearly 4,000 complaints we handled, almost 3 million in recovered benefits. First quarter of 2017, the numbers that I had available, 945 complaints and 1.2 million in recovered benefits. So considering that the vast majority of these are usually claim settlement practices, we actually do take care of a lot of problems at the front end. Moving on to compliance. So this is where we might suspect that the insurers are breaking the insurance code in some manner. So these are essentially examinations, right? So we go to the insurance company's place of business or we do an exam of their books and records that are given to us under the code to make sure that policyholders are being treated equitably and that the insurance companies are complying with statutes and regulations. So we do have about 1,500 companies in total that this insurance companies that are being examined at various times by this outfit. We, you know, given the deployment of limited resources, we're looking for things like high complaint indices, misleading sales practices, or at least potential misleading sales practices, problems found in financial examinations. So if there's so far colleagues find something maybe an irregularity in the financial books, then they can send something to compliance to see if there is a problem. And then information that we might receive from other regulatory entities. So we do work with all 50 state insurance regulators on areas of common interest. So information from these might actually indicate the need for additional investigation exams or additional market conduct response. The sources we receive are many. In the compliance section, my colleagues deal with consumer complaints, inquiries from legislative, so constituent issues, we also take those in the compliance section. Media reports, though, I mean, we'd like to hear that before it ever gets to the media stage, but we do try to look at those as we hear from all sources. Compliance is also the primary source of what we call data calls. So we actually use authority under the insurance code to receive information directly from the insurance companies on a variety of issues related to examinations. Typically, it's confidential because it's done in the course of an examination, investigation under the code. But those are, we do send quite a bit of letters, data calls to insurance companies to try to get answers to our questions. In terms of enforcement, we maintain a staff of investigators and officers that are responsible for gathering evidence and achieving resolution of violations through issuance of administrative orders, perhaps working with our partners at the Department of Justice to initiate civil actions in court, or working with state or federal law enforcement partners to initiate criminal prosecution. We don't prosecute ourselves, but we do try to maintain relationships to see if we can get some referrals on occasion. Enforcement works on cases spanning all lines of insurance and finance. But in any event, all of the work is done under the Administrative Procedures Act so that there's due process safeguards in place for parties involved. Most enforcement efforts are complaint-driven, but we can also take information obtained from exams in our compliance section or other sources of information coming in from other sections in the division. So enforcement has a range of tools available to them to ensure compliance and deter future unlawful conduct. Civil penalties are up to $10,000 per violation, with a $500,000, I think, continuing violation cap. So if something is continuing from one stretch, about $500,000 we can assess. We can issue cease and desist orders, so as deterring or telling an insurance company to stop particular conduct from occurring in the future. Ordering restitution, which at least in the insurance code is an order to an insurance carrier to compensate for actual damages. Sometimes restitution is treated differently in a legal context, but that's the way the insurance code defines restitution. Civil actions, again, we can go to court, and then criminal referrals. So in 2016, we opened 216 cases in the enforcement section alone. Denied, revoked licenses of 80 insurance agents for various bad acts. Issued 132 enforcement orders and assessed $1.3 million in civil penalties. I don't, unfortunately, have numbers for 2017, but I can certainly get those for the committee if they wish. Okay, so briefly, talking about the trade practice statutes. I won't give you the history that it was codified in 67 through House Bill 1320, because I think we don't have time for that. But basically, the trade practice statutes are a long-standing statutes that prohibit various practices under the insurance code. The one we use quite frequently is the anti-discrimination provisions in ORS 746.015, which bars discrimination between individuals of the same class and equal expectation of life. Other provisions are very specific to a particular line, probably solving a problem at the time, and were codified then. The statute that actually prohibits unfair claim settlement practices is in ORS 746.230. It's about 13 different kinds of activities that the statute covers, everything from adopting reasonable standards for investigating claims, paying out after a reasonable investigation, attempting to settle claims in good faith. The insurers can't compel claimants to sue just to receive a full payout, things like that. I won't belabor the entire statute for the committee, but over time, those have also been codified or clarified and amplified through administrative rule. And so there's a whole section of administrative rules on what is an unlawful claim settlement practice. In terms of consumers' remedy in the private context, I mean, insurance is at its core a contractual arrangement. While it's highly regulated, it is still a contract. And so a customer that is not receiving their expected benefits may have a remedy for breach of contract. Typically, that's a six-year statute of limitations under Oregon law. So ORS 12.010 says all breach of contract actions are 6 years. In terms of other remedies that are available to consumers, given that we're looking out for the insurance buying public as a whole, can't necessarily give legal advice on a specific situation. So other remedies are typically something that someone needs to discuss with their counsel. And so I will briefly cover mental health parity. This is an area where compliance and enforcement have been working together. Just gives an example for the committee. So in 2016, we received $1.2 million from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. I think I have that backwards, but it's okay. A third of that is devoted to doing exams for mental health parity compliance. So we actually have one person out in the field that is at one insurer right now that's going through the books and records, looking at trying to make sure that the insurance carrier is complying with mental health parity requirements under state and federal law. The grant work's continuing through August 31st of 2018. So we also are working with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to make sure that we have best practices for making sure insurance carriers are complying with mental health parity laws under federal law. So we had there was a two-day conference that my colleagues had attended in Maryland that the states and federal government shared best practices, and so we're using those lessons learned and applying that in the examinations that we're going through right now. In 2017, we also issued enforcement orders to four insurers. Initially, we had entities were receiving orders for about anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 assessed civil penalties based on noncompliance with the insurance code in terms of whether they were allowing certain types of behavioral therapy to be paid for. And so then this session, the legislature passed, that's actually Senate Bill 860, that's my fault. DCBS will incorporate into the exams that we are currently doing, field exams for insurance carriers, whether pay parity is being achieved between mental health providers and physical health providers. And so the compliance, we're using our compliance team to carry out the work that was directed by the legislature in 860. Just real briefly, again, product regulation. My colleagues are looking through the contracts, making objections when they find terms in the agreements that are contrary to Oregon law, that are made and amended prior to being used and filed and used in the state. The product regulation team also does the rate review process, so we go through the very robust and public process to set health insurance rates, and so they are the ones that in part are going through the public hearings, public conference calls, and receiving the comments on whether a rate is reasonable, not excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. And finally, my colleagues in the insurance institution section, they're the ones that are examining the financial condition of insurance companies. You may have heard we've had a few challenges in the last year or so with the co-ops, and we've actually had to file suit on one carrier this year for some financial irregularities. Again, making sure that their financial position is sound allows them to pay claims and appropriately manage risk. And so it's really important that we continue to do that work along with all the other compliance and enforcement activities. Just put this web on the web. This will be in OLIS, of course, but this is the website that consumers can access so that they can reach out to our consumer advocates, toll-free number, of course, and then direct email. So if there's any questions on that part of the presentation?
Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's just a couple of slides back, you said payment rate for mental health versus physical health.
Yeah.
So is there a kind of a standard in the industry that one profession would get a certain rate and another profession would get another rate?
Chair Holvey and Representative Barreto, my understanding is pay parity is linked to, I may ask you about this one. If I may defer this question to my colleague, sure. Tasha Sample.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, my name is Tasha Sample, and I'm Senior Policy Analyst with the Division of Financial Regulation. Historically, there has been a concern with providers being discriminated against based on their licensure type, because states license the different levels of providers based on state requirements, certifications, and such. And there has been concern historically that one type of provider is getting a lower level of pay or being paid less based on the licensure certification that they have, even though they may be performing the same level or a similar level of work.
So who determines that level of work then? Does the state?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, the state licensing board determines the level of work that the certification for a particular provider will allow. Insurers can further require credentialing in order to work with that particular insurance company, but it's actually the state licensing boards that determine what type of certification that that provider can perform on a daily basis.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you. I also serve on the healthcare committee, and I would love to have an appointment with one of you, the appropriate one, to talk a little bit about this parity and where we are.
Oh, thank you. Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnamer, I'd be happy to swing by your office and find some time to speak.
Okay. Tomorrow, you could, my secretary would be there. She could set it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I also have a question. I'm not seeing anybody else jumping into the queue here.
You may ask it.
Thank you. Getting approval from my vice chairs before I speak.
Are we going to vote on it?
So I was a little confused in one part of it where you said a consumer can sue an insurance company based on, you know, not getting their claims or whatever on breach of contract. Mm-hmm. So is that through the Unfair Claims Practices or Unfair Claims Settlement Act? That I wasn't sure there was a private action allowed through the Unfair Claims Settlement Act.
Chair Holvey, it is correct that there is no particular private right of action in the insurance code, but as these are contracts, there are still ability under, I suppose, common law theories of contract to sue.
But not specifically on the violations of the Unfair Claims Settlement Act.
Representative Holvey, my understanding is that the cause of action doesn't derive from the actual insurance code, but the breaking of the contract that is regulated by the insurance code.
So when I was seeing that slide that talked about the complaints and the recovered benefits, that does that mean that there was a violation, or is that officially a violation once there is a complaint and it results in recovered benefits that the insurance was not providing?
But Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that we're talking about the slide on enforcement or the slide on the advocacy part. What I would say is, if we go back here, my colleagues in advocacy are securing these benefits for people without a particular formal administrative remedy being completed. So negotiation with the carrier back and forth. And carriers agreeing to comply. Those would be recovered benefits.
So those don't constitute a violation because there's been a complaint filed and through the process somehow it gets remedied.
That's correct.
Now, is there, you know, because when I go through this, personally myself, it takes a tremendous amount of time and then I feel like I need to get an attorney. And is there restitution back to the consumer in? Does that happen? I mean, do they get their costs covered for attorney costs, for example, or?
Chair Holvey, my understanding in the advocacy process is that those benefits are typically I don't believe that like costs for attorneys and other matters, incidentals, are going to be covered by that. This is really when folks are calling in to make sure they're trying to receive the benefit that they thought was available to them under the insurance contract. Our team helps go through those and make sure that those benefits are being received there wouldn't be incidentals or other fees attached to that. It's really just getting the insurance carriers to comply with what the promises were.
Right. So do you actually track that all the way through, though? When you get a complaint, it's tracked whether, you know, it's settled and there's recovered benefits, or, you know, what the, I guess, disposition of that complaint was? Did it get settled? Did it go to court? Did the insurance provider prevail? Did the consumer prevail, you know, those sorts of questions. How well is that tracked, I guess?
It is tracked. Chair Holvey, it is tracked. So, and what our hope is that the consumer advocacy, that piece is that the hope is the consumer didn't have to get an attorney. Mm-hmm. That they came to us and said their insurance company said, no, I won't pay for this. And then our advocates work with the consumers and the insurance company to help get them their benefits paid. Mm-hmm. So, but we do track that. We track that the benefits were paid and if there was an attorney. But the hope is during this phase, there are no attorneys involved. Am I correct, Brian? Okay, yes.
Right. Okay, but if that doesn't work, I would imagine
it's
a consumer.
The enforcement slide.
The consumer is sort of forced into getting an attorney, I would assume, or, you know, I'm trying to understand how that, because I've heard complaints about, you know, people's ability to actually get attorneys to help them with insurance.
Well, and Chair Holvey, if we can't get compliance in our consumer advocacy, then those cases will get transferred over to our enforcement and to our investigative teams.
Right.
And then we investigate further. And that's when the fines happen and restitution would be recovered in that phase.
So
that's my understanding of how this works.
So once there are civil penalties and enforcement orders, that's when the consumer also gets restitution through the agency itself?
At times, yes. It's not always. It just depends on the case and what is settled and what is determined and what is found.
Okay. Yeah, it's all sort of confusing because there's different parts of law when it comes to enforcement versus consumer advocacy, and I was just wondering how the consumer gets restitution for, you know, being wronged by an insurance provider when they're in violation or not providing the benefit,
right?
Other than through a breach of contract, I guess, is what you're saying is. At that point, it becomes a breach of contract, and they can sue on the breach of contract.
Chair Holvey, that's my understanding. Under restitution, too, that is one of the tools that we can use in our claims, in our process when we're issuing the order. There's a violation, and here's the potential remedies we have, civil penalty.
If you're tracking that, I'd be curious to know how often consumers get restitution in that process.
So, Chair Holvey, we have our manager of our advocacy group.
Nice one in here. Clarify, it's medical insurance.
This is not necessarily medical.
All medical. Can we get that on the record?
Representative Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Brian Fordham. I'm the section manager of the advocacy unit that we're talking about. And so when a complaint comes through the door, we reach out to the insurance company, as my colleagues have already pointed out, attempt to remedy a solution. Specifically, as it relates to your questions, as it pertains to restitution, that's done via order. So in order to achieve restitution from our agency, it would be part of an enforcement action that's done by our enforcement unit. And this would be both for property casualty as well as for medical.
Thank you.
Certainly.
So the restitution is actually something that's decided at the agency level on each individual case?
At the time of an enforcement action.
Okay. Sure.
Well, I think you were getting at this. When the case is not resolved through the consumer advocate and it's switched over to enforcement, does the consumer still have a role in that investigation? Do they have an attorney, or is it all just in the hands of the agency at that point?
Certainly. And so to answer that question, at the point we receive a complaint, if we identify that there is a violation of the law, we look for, like I said, an attempted remedy. So that would be negotiation with the insurance company to ensure that we get compliance. If at the point we identify that we're unable to achieve compliance, we refer to our compliance section. The purpose of doing so is so that we can do a broad-based evaluation of the organization to determine the depth and breadth of the noncompliance. So they'll issue data calls like like Rick discussed. They will do a formal investigation of the organization to determine what specifically the components of the violation are. At the point that that investigation is complete, that would be then referred to our enforcement unit. So a consumer could, in theory, be contacted periodically throughout that process as a point of developing information. But as it relates to their individual complaint, at the point that it is referred over to compliance, we are no longer looking at the individual complaint, but rather we're looking at company behavior. So it has elevated to a different level, and that individual consumer is not involved.
Okay. Well, I don't see any other questions. I appreciate that overview. As you know, we get questions and bills about insurance quite often, and find it a confusing space sometimes, no doubt about it. So I appreciate your overview, and I'm sure with individuals that have follow-up questions specific, that they will do that, which is sort of the purpose of this, was to give people a basic concept of how you operate and what the laws are and what your process is. So I appreciate your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we staying?
So, and Rick, you don't need to get up, evidently. Make yourself comfortable. We did add on a last piece to this committee hearing, basically to give the committee an update on the Equifax data breach. I know that many of you may be receiving inquiries from constituents about what they should be doing and, you know, what the heck is going on with their information being handled by third parties. And so with that, we'll just go ahead and bring up Cheryl Heemstra, who's already here, Rick Blackwell, who's already here, and Brian Fordham, who's already here. So thank you so much for being here. And I guess, Cheryl, you get to kick this off.
Sure, sounds good.
You can tell us what happened.
We can, yes. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. I believe we had a PowerPoint. Awesome, thank you. So Equifax data breach was announced about 12 days ago. It's a big one. 1.7 million Oregonians are affected, 143 million nationwide. Not the biggest data breach by numbers, but probably one of the worst by the type of information that was breached. Basically, the hackers got the crown jewels. They got your social, your driver's license, your name, your address. If anybody wants to create a fake account in your name, that's what they need. So it's a very bad breach that way. Unlike a retail breach, you know, at a store, you can say, you know what, I don't trust that company more. I'm not going to shop there anymore. The unfortunate thing with Equifax is they're a credit reporting agency. So anytime you need credit, you know, car, house, some employers check it, right? You're interacting with Equifax, maybe with or without your knowledge. If you go to the next slide. This is a basic chart on how it works, but basically lenders are taking the data you submit when you want to apply for credit, sending it to Equifax and the other two credit reporting agencies, TransUnion and Experian, and then pumping out that FICO score. So we've been getting a lot of consumer complaints on this, and some people just don't even understand, you know, how did this Equifax company get my information, and why is it breached? They're very upset with the fact that Equifax has all this information. And like I said, you know, these are the crown jewels. This is what people can use to impersonate you and open up accounts in your name, which can significantly affect your score, and then, you know, you're in a lot of other trouble when you try to get housing or a loan, et cetera. So here's a brief outline of kind of the timeline of the breach. So March 8th of this year, researchers report a security flaw to all of industry saying, hey, there's this back door we found. Please lock it. Put up some security in place. May 13, the hackers find that Equifax did not close this door and break in, basically. July 29, Equifax starts seeing some suspicious traffic on their website, starts looking into it. August 2, they hire a cyber investigators, a company called Mandiant. August 22, they set up a website, which is now the website being used to respond to the breach. And September 7, they announced the breach. The intrusion ran from May 13 to July 30. So over 2 months where this door was open and hackers were getting at all this information, which is probably why the numbers are so very large. And it took them until September 7 to alert the public. In response to the action, Equifax has, you know, tried to remediate, but I would call their actions a little bit troubled. So they're offering a one-year subscription to credit monitoring. Of course, it's their credit monitoring, and they've just been breached. It's called Trusted ID Premier. I want to note that because sometimes what happens after these breaches is they'll be offered free credit monitoring. The free version will be kind of the silver level, but then maybe sometimes consumers get upsold to the gold or platinum level, and all of a sudden they're getting charges on their credit cards that are sort of the automatic charges. The attorneys general have pressed Equifax not to require a credit card number in order to sign up for the free credit monitoring, so hopefully that auto renewal won't be happening with this breach. But if we didn't get any promises about not upselling them to a different version, so just want to flag that for your constituents. Another unfortunate problem with this is 1 year is great, but of course the hackers are reading that headline too. They're probably going to wait a year and then start using your information, and you no longer have the monitoring. Equifax is waiving the credit freeze fee, and I'll get into this in a minute, and DCBS has more on this, but it's basically $10 in Oregon to place a freeze on your account, and you also have to pay $10 to unfreeze it. So unfortunately, after November 21, it's still going to cost you the $10 to unfreeze, and Experian is not covering the other two agencies. In order to really freeze your credit, you need to call all three, and DCBS will have more about that. Getting a lot of complaints from consumers about clogged phone lines. I went on their website last week, Thursday, and it said, please come back on Tuesday when the traffic is not so high in order to get information. So unfortunately, that's also happening. They are hiring a lot of people right now, I know, to man the phone lines. But that's been an issue. So if you do have consumers with complaints, please send them our way. We did post a scam alert up onto OLIS with information about what to do, and I'll get into that in a minute. One of the things that came out in the news was for this free credit monitoring, Equifax put in a provision kind of hidden into the terms about waiving your legal rights to sue them, sort of a mandatory arbitration agreement like they do standard. We pushed back on that. They did remove it retroactively and moving forward. So that's no longer in there. So that's good. And also on their website, they have this tool where you can stick in your last six of the of your social security number and your last name, and then it'll pop out a result to whether or not you've been breached. Unfortunately, people have been testing that. They put in fake information and says, oh, you've been breached. Or people are getting different results. If they put in the same information on their phone and their computer, it'll give them different results. So it's not a very reliable tool. Really, just vigilance and caution is the word of the day, which gets me into things you can do to send your constituents. This is all in the scam alert that's on OLIS. And just presenting in for your colleagues over in the Judiciary Committee, they asked that we send our scam alert out to all 90 members. So you'll be getting that as well. Main things people can do, check your credit reports. People are going to be trying, if hackers have sold the information, trying to open up accounts. So check your credit reports. Like I said, there's three credit reporting agencies. So basically a good thing to do is every 4 months, call up one of the agencies and just kind of put them on rotation. It's very important you go to annualcreditreport.com. There are a lot of things you can Google, say, you know, credit report, and then some companies will try to get you to pay for what you can already get for free. So that's the website to go to. Another good website is identitytheft.gov. This is the FTC, and they will actually do a step-by-step click-through of how to respond to a data breach and what you can do. They've already updated for the Equifax breach, so it's a really good step-by-step tool. Place a credit freeze. That's probably the best thing you can do at this point to protect yourself. File your taxes early. We've had a lot of identity theft in the tax realm where people will file on your behalf, get your refund, and by the time you file your taxes, your refund's gone. So that's something also to watch out for. So what we have in Oregon already for existing law, thankfully we do have a data breach law that covers some of this. Breached entities must send notification to the Attorney General if it's more than 250. That's definitely the case here. And then they can either send individual notice or media notice. I think it's if it's over $250,000 for them to send individual notice, they can opt to do media notice, which is what Equifax is opting to do here. We do have their notification up on our website as well, from Equifax itself. In Oregon law, there's a duty to maintain reasonable security for personal information. So what I can say at this point is usually with these type of breach cases, we get together with other attorneys general and really take a good hard look at what happened here, what security practices were in place. You know, at this point, we know that the unlocked door was there, and they had warning about it. That's public information, but at this point, that's about all I can say. I will note that the law currently only applies to personal information. So that's your social, your financials, a few other things. But Equifax had a lot more information on us than just that. There was a statistic. They gather every day 1,200 times the amount of the Library of Congress combined every single day. It's a lot of data. There's no real protection in Oregon law for that sort of data. Something we're definitely going to keep an eye on. And then finally, credit freezes, and DCBS will have some more information on that. But some states are free. Some states range from $3, and $10 is the max, and that's what Oregon's at. So happy to answer questions. This is a doozy of a breach, and we will certainly be looking into it.
Thank you.
You're done.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, again, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager with the Division of Financial Regulation. We'll go ahead and skip the why are we here, because I think Cheryl did a good job explaining well, we're here because of Equifax. Just briefly understanding the differences, the credit freeze is a statutory mandated mechanism that blocks access to a consumer's credit file. We're seeing credit locks and credit fraud alerts as listed alternatives. These are proprietary products, though, as Cheryl mentioned. They may afford the same protection, but also, as Cheryl said, there are contractual differences between the default product, the default freeze in state law, and the products that you might see coming from other entities or from the entities themselves. And so, in terms of placing a freeze, a bureau has to put it in place within 5 days of receiving the request from the consumer, and confirm it back to the consumer within 10 days of writing. Lifting a freeze has to be done within 3 business days of receiving the request.
Does that request have to be in writing?
Chair Holvey, I will make sure to find out. As we have homework to all 90 members, we'll make sure that that's included.
So. I'll just add a little more homework for you.
Exactly. I hope my folks back home are hearing that. In terms of freeze and lift fees, the law allows a fee of up to $10 to be assessed per credit reporting agency. As the prior presentation noted, there really are only 3 credit bureaus that focus on this kind of consumer information, and so they're the ones that are typically ones that a consumer is going to reach out to both to freeze their file and to lift that freeze as needed for obtaining credit, for the purposes of obtaining credit. The law does not allow these to be charged to folks that are victims of identity theft. So this would be the criminal identity theft, like a crime of identity theft. Victims of personal identity theft, so probably not, maybe not necessarily that raises to the level of obtaining a police report. And so those that are younger than age 16, those are protected persons under the law. A conservator or guardian can actually freeze a file for someone before they have credit. So we're not necessarily suggesting at this point to go to the police. I mean, this, while Cheryl notes this is a very bad breach, there may not necessarily be evidence of a crime yet either, and so going to the police may not net you any report in order to provide to get out of the credit, to get out of the $10 per agency fee. So certainly folks that are affected may end up still having to pay, depending on both whether, well, Equifax continues to not charge the fee and whether the other two bureaus are amenable to reducing or waiving the fee for this particular situation.
How do you establish that you are a victim of identity theft? Is it an official police report, or is it an FTC file number, or...
Chair Holvey, I'll have to follow up. My sense is usually the police report is the one where you have identified that you're the victim. Otherwise, it may be records from a financial institution, if you've disputed. And that one I'll have to actually defer to my colleagues as well. So.
Yeah, Chair Holvey, on that, the FTC does have a tool for you to get an affidavit showing you have been a victim of identity theft. However, you do need evidence of somebody opened an account in my name. It's not just my information was breached. It's that an account was opened or charges on my credit card or something to that effect.
Thank you. Question?
Thank you, Chair. So what retribution do folks have, or what can they do given the fact that Equifax knew they had a problem, they didn't do anything about it? Obviously, there will be people that will suffer probably, severe issues for years to come from this. And what do they do? I mean, how are they just supposed to go, oh, gee, we're sorry, we did nothing about this, but, you can't buy a home for the next 10 years of your life. And, I mean, identity theft wreaks havoc on people for years and years and years. So what retribution do they have? Do they sue Equifax? What do they do?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hack. So yes, this is also brought up in judiciary. This is a very bad breach because it's got your social, and that has a very long tail. I mean, that can go the rest of your life.
Yep.
With a credit card breach, you can change your credit card number, but your social, I mean, it's meant to stay with you for life.
Tax returns,
I mean, all of that. So there's a few things. There is, as I mentioned, the Attorney General actions possible. That's under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And so that's $25,000 per violation, up to $25,000 per violation for a company that violates that act. They would violate it by not having reasonable security or not giving notice on time, something like that. There is also, of course, the consumer remedies, general breach of contract or deception, that kind of thing. And I believe there's a private class action already being started against Equifax. So those are the two routes. DCBS also has some authority, especially in the credit freeze area as well. So
Does the data breach actually, you mentioned that there was a, I'm sorry, did you have follow up? I'm following up on your follow up, but
the only other follow up I had on the class action. So if the credibility of the was I breached, was I not breached is in question, does anybody and everybody join in on the class action in case that they're a potential? I mean, 1.7 million Oregonians were affected here. So do you tell your constituents, yourself? I mean, does everybody just join in on the class action, assuming that you were breached? Because you probably were. So if you don't join in on the class action and 10 years from now, 5 years from now, they've got your Social Security number and, oh, gee, my, they've gone out and racked up credit, or they've filed a tax return, or they've gotten hold of my Social Security check or whatever. If you don't join the class action because you think you weren't breached but you actually were breached, would it be best to just join the class action and wait and see how it goes?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hack, while I cannot give legal advice, that would probably be a good idea to take a good hard look at that. You know, again, the Attorney General is going to be working on this, I'm sure, for quite a while, but the tricky thing about data breach is you don't necessarily know this is from the Equifax data breach case, and so that can get kind of tricky factually. But with half the state breached, I mean, and that's you know, adults and children combined, chances are we've all been breached here.
But to her point, under this data breach, you know, that's identified, I think, in unfair trade practices.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding it's not the one that comes with a private right of action.
Right. So
an individual consumer really doesn't have a private right of action but could join a class action suit.
Correct.
So as an individual consumer, you're not going to get your attorney fees paid for by employing an attorney to help defend you or to sue the Equifax in this particular case, if that was the company. I'm just trying to understand how a consumer,
sure,
you know, ultimately ends up protecting themselves other than relying on the Department of Justice and Department of Consumer Business Services to, you know, bring civil action against Equifax, which may not necessarily recover anything for an individual consumer.
Chair Holvey, I want to be really careful not to exclude any legal arguments that might be forthcoming and getting creative with the UTPA or with any other sort of law, so I'll let the private attorneys figure that one out.
All right, thanks. Yeah. It might have been an unfair question, I don't know. Representative Barreto.
Well, I'm thinking 1.7 million Oregonians are 143 million U.S. consumers. That's just about everybody with a Social Security number and whoever's borrowed money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's everybody, but just about, that has that's an adult.
Joey Reparto, yeah, that's correct.
And for the other credit reporting agencies, or not Equifax since they're waiving the credit freeze, but I would imagine there's going to be a boon of business for them now that would be quite profitable.
Yes, Chair Holvey.
Ultimately, for in Oregon, $10 for every credit freeze.
I've read reports that the other two, with their identity theft protection services, are already upping their prices. LifeLock, as it turns out, of course, is doing what they can to help out consumers. As it turns out, I saw an article that just this morning, LifeLock actually has a contract with Equifax. So the services they're using are in consultation with Equifax. So when our system depends on, you know, three credit reporting agencies for the entire nation, it's...
Yeah, it almost seems like a conflict of interest.
Doesn't it, though?
This is, you know, pretty disturbing, you know, that our financial industry has gotten to this point of using the credit reporting agencies and FICO scores for everything under the sun and have so much information and data that they can't protect. And now, you know, all our constituents' financial future is at risk,
mm-hmm.
you know, and boy, what do we do with that? And, you know, where are those holes in our regulation that we've been talking about for years and years and years on these issues, and it doesn't, you know, it's really disturbing. So what do we do?
Well, we can, Mr. Chair, we can do a mundane thing and freeze our credit, for starters.
Well, you think you can, but frankly, I've tried unsuccessfully. You go through the website, you fill out all the information, you get to the end after about 20 minutes, and it goes, "We're sorry, we cannot do this with the information you've provided." And then I go to the phone, so call this number. And I get elevator music for 45 minutes, and then they hung up on me. So I'm just wondering how, you know, and the clock is ticking as this data breach has exposed my information that I know. And so it's a frustrating place to be, and you know, I'm not much more sophisticated than the regular consumer, but maybe a little. And, you know, it's a challenging space for a consumer to even go through their own process to protect yourself. And you're wondering about whether these fraud alerts or security locks really do anything in protecting your information.
Chair Holby, yeah. I'll just add, we've heard a lot of complaints from older Oregonians or maybe rural Oregonians that they're trying to get through on the phone lines and just get dropped, unfortunately. And I know Equifax is hiring a lot of people right now to answer those phones, but it's going to be a rocky process. Yeah.
Where you go to lift the freeze, and then it takes them days to put the freeze back on, because I had a freeze, had to lift the freeze because you actually want to use your credit. So then they lift the freeze. It takes them days to lift the freeze, so they continue to try to pull your credit that whole time. Then it takes days to put it back on, and then you're vulnerable in between. It's not, the system is, it's a mess. I could say more, but I'll.
Mr. Chair, we did include the links and the contact information for the placing.
But before you go there,
be effective.
Before you go, freeze.equifax.com. Yes, that's the one I visited.
Yeah, right.
But before you go there, is there, I mean, because it really does seem like a conflict of interest if, in fact, there's going to be profiteering off of all these credit freezes that are going to be coming from millions of constituents across. It would seem like there'd be something in our rules or statutes that could compel them to waive these particular credit freezes in this sort of scenario. Is there anything like that in our statutes, or are they just free to take that $10 from 1.7 million Oregonians?
Chair Holvey, as the statute's constructed right now, the allowance is that any freeze or thaw can come with a fee, and there isn't. I don't believe there's any way for us to be able to write that out of statute by rule. So,
okay. Alrighty. Well, any more good questions?
What a pleasant note to end on.
What's that?
What a pleasant note to end on.
Well, thanks for making us aware of this and providing us information. And, you know, since the Judiciary Committee has sought wise to inform all legislators with this information, that's a great idea because I know I've been getting calls on this issue and not really having good answers except to call DCBS and the Department of Justice. You know, that's the only answer I have right now, and I'm uncertain whether to tell them to get an attorney because I don't know if they can get attorney fees for helping them through this or whether attorneys will take it. It seems like adding salt to a wound when you have to pay an attorney to help defend your private information that's, you know, being stored and sold across the world. So. Well, gosh, thanks a lot for your testimony. I appreciate you making this presentation for us and doing it in a timely fashion.
Thank you. Thank you.
Happy to help. And I'll just add, we have our consumer protection hotline that's manned by wonderful AARP volunteers and our website. So send them our way.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Jan, do we have any other business?
There's no more business.
No more business. And so thank you very much, committee members, for being here for this fascinating day of agency overviews. And with that, I will adjourn the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. Interim Committee on Business and Labor. With that, I will adjourn the House